This is The Shakeout.
Still there, still within striking distance. Bishop challenging. Showman Shaw. Close race towards the finish line.
He might do it. Look at that guy. Look at Plant Zero.
Oh my God.
There's Salazar. Can he have enough? Salazar kicking.
This has to be the greatest race of his life.
Welcome to the Fearless episode. My name is Michael Doyle. I am the editor of Canadian Running Magazine. And with me today in studio is web editor Sinead Mulhern. Hello, Sinead.
Hi, Michael.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing well, although I'm a little sad. We're missing someone.
Tim.
There is no Tim Hubes today.
He's down the street in his apartment.
We gave Tim the day off. Tim can't work 24/7.
I know.
So it's just Sinead and I today for the episode, but we've got a great one.
Yes, I'm excited about this episode.
Pretty exciting. We've got two segments today. In our first segment, you chatted with an author. Tell us a little bit about who you're talking to.
Yeah, I chatted with Canadian Louise Green. She is the author of a really great book called Big Fit Girl. It's about embracing body image and promoting a body positive image for women in sports and all types of fitness.
And in our second segment, Sinead and I got to chat with icon of the sport, Catherine Switzer. Of course, Catherine is best known perhaps for being the first woman to ever officially run the Boston Marathon with a bib.
Yes.
And the ensuing drama and chaos that occurred in 1967 mm-hmm. when she did that. Mm-hmm. And of course, her career as a runner, a journalist, a commentator, and just generally, as I said, an icon of the sport. Mm-hmm. And she's running the New York City Marathon this fall. And we talked to her all about her approach, her training, and mm-hmm. her big year.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's been an amazing year for Catherine Switzer. That was a really fun conversation. Louise Green is a motivational speaker, a guest writer, and the author of a new book called Big Fit Girl. It is about embracing the body that you have while you are working out, be it in the CrossFit gym, be it at a race or running. We spoke to Louise Green about certain things that women need to keep in mind when they are working out in order to properly embrace their figure and stay healthy through their training. Okay, Louise, so you are the author of Big Fit Girl, which is a great fitness manual for plus-sized women. So that came out, that's a fairly recent book that has come out on the shelves. Why don't you kind of start off by telling me, you know, what you were setting out to achieve when you started working on this book?
Okay, so yes, that did come out in March. Mm-hmm. And basically, I had been working as a personal trainer in the fitness industry for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And as a trainer, had many intimate conversations with my clients and would go to the fitness bookshelves at the bookstore, often for my own personal interest. And I would never see anything that was really speaking to the conversations that I was having with these women. Mm-hmm. So there seemed to be a big gap in information that larger bodied women were not getting in the fitness bookshelves. Hmm. Like, there wasn't anything that was tackling the intimidation that many of us feel, or how to even get started, or, you know, how to work out in a body that's bigger. So there seemed to be this big gap.
Mm-hmm. And actually, you kind of did a good job at breaking down your own experience. One thing that you wrote about was the moment where you're in line and you're running the half marathon, but the guy assumes that you're running the 5K. So there were things like that. Why don't you kind of go through some of your own experiences, or maybe the experiences of women who you've worked with and trained, and kind of just tell me a little bit about times that you've noticed being stereotyped and how you've advised women to sort of get past that?
Well, I face the stereotype on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So it's something I've become very accustomed to. And it's not something I really take offense to, because I believe that people are conditioned to believe what they see. So when we are dealing with a media landscape that very rarely includes larger bodied athletes, mm-hmm. it's hard for people to understand that there are larger bodied athletes. So I kind of understand where people are coming from, but it's just things like exactly that specific story that I told in the book and other interviews is going to pick up my half marathon package. And without even asking me, this guy reaches for the 5K, whereas thinner bodied people are being asked, are you doing the five or are you doing the half?
Right.
So it's just that kind of thing. There's many times where people will say, like, they'll do like the slow clap, good for you.
Right. Yeah.
You know, that kind of it, you know, they're trying to be supportive, but it comes across very condescending when I've been a running coach for 10 years. You know, just things like that. And there's been times where I've taken my women to fun 5Ks and we've gotten to the finish line and they're already packing up, things like that, where it's like, we're not necessarily being that inviting to a certain demographic.
Right, right. And so something that I get asked from time to time is, you know, a larger bodied woman will approach me and say, you know, I'm looking to get into running or I want to start getting more active. What are the first things that I need to know about? I felt that that would be a really appropriate question to throw to you. What do you say when you get those kinds of questions?
Well, I don't ever say to people, oh, you should really start with water aerobics or like, you know, I believe that if somebody has the desire to run, they should give it a go. And a lot of people will say, well, it's going to hurt your joints. It's going to do this. You're going to get injured. But what I say is go low and slow. Mm-hmm. So keep it really close to the ground, go super slow and try to find a run program that is very slow and progressive. So, you know, I've done many different 5K running plans and some of them will start at running 1 minute or 2 minutes. And for somebody that's new and in a larger body, that can even still be too aggressive. So like say 20 seconds, then walk for two, 20 seconds, walk for two, and really take it nice and slow.
And that's actually an interesting point. Like I think with a lot of say beginners, especially, people think that they're supposed to be going faster than, like they always are sort of thinking about, picking the pace up. So you're actually saying, no, dial it back and go slower and really focus on maybe going slower than you even think that you should be going at the beginning.
Yeah. And I mean, I've had people say to me from my plans, well, this is boring and I want to jump ahead. Like we all are, many of us have that, all or nothing mentality where it's like, go hard. I'm all in. There's like this fitness honeymoon where people like get really excited and that's totally commendable. But I think there's a method to the madness. And if you can go really low and slow in the beginning, you're going to condition your body and you're going to get yourself in a position where you can then start to progress without injury.
Mm-hmm. What about like cross training? Do you ever recommend certain cross training activities for people or even, you know, small little workouts that they can do alone in their apartment or something like that? That would complement their running?
I think cross training is really smart when you're running because running is hard on your body. Like I haven't run for a while. And I went for a run the other night, ran 5K. And the next day I was like, wow, I've been doing a lot of cycling and swimming for other events. And so there's a huge difference between cycling a long distance and running a short distance. My body really felt it. And so cross training to make sure that your body has the strength to handle that demand is really important. So doing, you know, squats and lunges and working on your core stability is going to really help in having your body manage the demand that you're putting on it.
Mm-hmm. So if someone's kind of revamping their fitness or maybe even, you know, approaching a fitness routine for the first time or getting into running for the first time, they might look to find a coach or a personal trainer. And I know that you wrote a little bit about some things that you should look for with a trainer. So I just wanted to know if you could share some of those tips, say, for the listener who maybe has had a bad experience with, you know, not getting set up with the trainer who is really a good fit for them.
Well, my running coach 15 years ago completely changed my life. Mm-hmm. She's the reason I'm a personal trainer. She's the reason I started, you know, leading other people to run. And she approached me from a position of athletic performance over trying to achieve a better bikini body or trying to whittle myself down. So often when we are performing physical fitness on a regular basis and we're fueling our body for athletic performance, often a side benefit to that is change in body composition or weight reduction. But what I like to tell people to do is don't work. I find what works for me is not to work with somebody that's what they're 100% focused on.
Yeah.
So they're not pushing those 1200 calorie plans. They're not really harping on you to get your body size down. Because we know as athletes, especially runners, you have to eat and you have to eat a fair abundance of food to sustain the demand.
Oh, of course.
So you want to find somebody that has some knowledge in what kind of food that looks like and what's going to speak to your best performance. But to be body positive about it and just to get you going and to believe in you as you are today and to mold you into the athlete that you can be. I'm not a big fan of bikini seasons coming or tank top seasons coming. Let's go. I don't believe in any kind of motivation with an underlying tone of shame.
Mm-hmm. Actually, that kind of leads to something that I wanted to ask you about, which is about setting realistic goals, because I know that a lot of people will automatically assume, oh, you're a runner, it's because you're trying to lose weight or, you're trying to slim down. How does someone approach making realistic goals? And what would you say are examples of goals that would be kind of something that would be more healthy to go after?
I say if you're starting with your first experience running and you're picking a 5K distance, the goal is to finish injury free.
Mm-hmm.
Like really, that's it. That's, you know, for somebody that's brand new to running, just to get in your 3 runs a week or 4, whatever you decide to do, that's huge in of itself, right? You're going from you're going from a sedentary lifestyle to now running 3 times a week.
Yeah.
If you can get that long run in and the homework runs done and just complete what the schedule says every week and finish injury free, I think that that's a huge, huge accomplishment.
And then, okay, so obviously, and you kind of mentioned this earlier in our conversation, obviously, you know, if you're engaging in an active lifestyle, you're becoming a runner and you're running, you know, 3-4 times a week. Okay, so diet is becoming a very big part of that. You have to make sure that you are eating enough to fuel your lifestyle. So you talked about a lot of things like restrictive eating, how not to get hangry, even things like reward eating when, you know, you go for a 5K run and then afterwards you feel like, oh, I did the work, so therefore I should be able to indulge in this snack now. So I thought that you touched on a lot of really interesting points that are pretty much applicable to every type of runner. And I just wanted to know, you know, how you got there and if you could tell us a little bit about your breakthrough in learning to become a healthier eater.
Well, I lived many, many years hungry. So I was and I had this constant like feeling of dissatisfaction all the time because I wasn't eating what I needed, but I was following plans that were telling me like, you get this amount of points, you get this amount of calories, that's all you get. Right. And so I was trying to follow that and I was really unhappy. And like I said, I was always hungry and I just don't feel that being an athlete involves hunger. It just, you have to replenish and you have to fuel for that performance. So, basically when I met that running coach and she was like, let's just do our high, like work to our highest athletic potential here. And, you know, she would say these are the types of food that are going to give you energy. And within my book, I talk about, you know, if we're eating a lot of sugar, we're going to be having sugar crashes. And if you have a run plan that night, you're probably going to feel all bummed out about it and not want to do it. If we're eating too much, like it's not really, when I wrote about these things in the book, it wasn't about restriction and diets. Yeah. It was more about energy. So if we eat a big, huge lunch, and then we're like sleeping at our desk all afternoon, but you have a workout that night, it's not going to work. Or if you're eating just a carbohydrate diet that's simple, complex carbohydrates, and you're, you know, it's not going to lend to the energy that you need to do these certain things.
Yeah. You're going to crash and burn.
Yeah. And I mean, you need every, I mean, I have a son, I have a business, I'm usually always training for things. If I don't strategically work every single energy angle to my advantage, I can't do it.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So there's a question that we get a lot here. And I think it's probably more common than people know. Someone listening right now is probably thinking the exact same thing. It's, you know, the woman who wants to do these things, who sees other people who are active and living the runner's lifestyle, but who is embarrassed to go out, or who is embarrassed to go to the gym, or maybe is planning a run, but does so, you know, only when it's dark outside.
I hear this a lot, all the time.
So yeah. what is your response to that? What do you kind of want that listener to be keeping in mind if she's listening and thinking, yeah, that's me?
Well, and that was me. You know, that night that I joined 15 years ago, I was not feeling very confident about what I looked like and who I was at that time. So I very much relate. But the point being is, at some point, if you want these things, you're going to have to put yourself out there. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just no way around it. I mean, they don't have races in the middle of the night. If you want to, you know, well, maybe they do some places, but
it's not as common.
There's some night runs, but, you know, and I think that it's really important part of the body positive movement is that you need to be seen. Mm-hmm. And that's why I make myself as visible as possible and put myself out there as much as possible, because we need to let it be known that this isn't an anomaly. This is something that's actually happening. Like, when you go to a half marathon, there are people of all shapes and sizes.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
When you go to a 5K, there are people of all shapes and sizes. So to that listener, I want you to know that despite what you see in a lot of fitness media, when you actually arrive, there is diversity.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And so to be a part of that diversity is really a power move. So I think if you can soften the intimidation with joining with a friend or joining a group that really elevates you, that can really soften the intimidation. But the point is, you have to, if you want it, you have to at some point break through that fear and get out there.
Mm-hmm. I liked your chapter on paying it forward. So if you're a person who has sort of gone through this journey, who used to be that girl who is now, you know, more active about inspiring and motivating other people, that kind of made me think about, you know, what are some things that other runners in the community, who maybe this isn't their experience, but what are some things that people in the running community can do to motivate and encourage the person who is kind of having trouble getting out there, or who is learning to run for the first time and going to these road races for the first time?
I think just to lead by example and to be there for them, like we just talked about when I said soften the blow of intimidation, like extend your hand and say, hey, do you want to go for a run with me? And often people's response are, I'm not your pace, you're way faster than me, all that jazz. Right. But just say, it's not for me. It's I'm here to support you. Right. So I'm going to run at any interval that works for you and get people going. I mean, running is such a huge gift.
Great. Okay, Louise, thank you so much. This has been more than a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much.
And in our second segment, we chat with Catherine Switzer, running icon and first woman to ever run the Boston Marathon officially with a bib. This year was the 50th anniversary of Catherine's controversial and defining run at the Boston Marathon, where she laced up the shoes again and ran the race. We talked to her a little bit about that experience, but we also look ahead to the future. And we talked to her about her plan to run the New York City Marathon this fall and her organization 261 Fearless, and what the next 50 years of women's running is going to look like.
Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So you are running New York. It's right around the corner, and we just kind of wanted to check in because it's been quite a big year for you. So the first kind of question would be the obvious one, which is how did that decision kind of come up? How did you decide that you were going to add New York to your year this year?
Well, it's interesting, Sinead, that you ask the question about New York, because I woke up with a palpitating heart this morning saying I've got to get a 20-mile run within the next 3 days. Otherwise, I'm not going to be on schedule for crossing the finish line in New York. And I have such an incredible speaking schedule since Boston. It's been unbelievable. And so I just really had to fit it in. And then I found the day, and I feel really happy about it. So why I decided to run New York is interesting. First of all, Boston was a really good experience. And I was in better shape than I realized. The race came to me in a beautiful way. Much better than I expected, because when I went to the starting line in Boston, I was really, really exhausted from the media, not from the training, but from the media. But it all played out really, really well. And so I said, well, look, I'm in really pretty good shape. I'd lost about 10 pounds.
And, yeah.
And I thought, hey, why not run New York? Because I won New York in 1974.
Exactly.
But I'd never run through the streets. When I won it, it was in Central Park. 4 laps of Central Park, which is actually very hard with those hills. But I'd been on the back of a motorcycle or in a TV studio going through the streets of New York for 28 years. So I knew the neighborhoods really well. I knew the crowds. I knew the fascination. But I had never experienced it personally as a runner. And it's a great thing being alongside of Paula Radcliffe when she's, you know, sweating and spitting on you and setting a record. But it's a whole other thing also to experience it yourself. And I thought, well, if I don't do it this year, when?
Exactly.
I'm in shape. I'm 70. I'm not getting any younger. It's about time to do it. Now it's going to be fascinating, because in New York, they're actually going to be wiring me for my vital signs. And
interesting.
And I had a bad dream about that last night, which was like the commentator in the studio when he's seeing my heart rate and my body temperature will say, "Whoa, she'd better be pulled at the next station." So it's going to be an interesting race. And we have 10 wonderful 261ers, meaning they're part of the 261 Fearless team, my charity, who are also going to be running with me, maybe not exactly alongside, but we're all going to be in the race together, raising money for my charity, 261 Fearless, like we did in Boston, which is just tremendous.
Right, right. Okay, and so one of the things that I wanted to ask you was, okay, so you've run New York. You're not, this is not new to you to be running New York. And as you mentioned, you won it in 1974. So I kind of wanted to know about your thoughts sort of going into it and if it's going to be a bit of an emotional experience for you.
I think it's going to be a tremendously emotional experience because, as I said, you know, I know the streets pretty well, but I've never actually had the privilege of running them. And the crowds are going to be tremendous. Everybody says it's an exalting experience. I know what it feels like being on a motorcycle going across the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, leading the race and looking at the cityscape of New York. But to actually be running it and feeling it is a whole different ballgame. I'm really excited. I mean, New York is my town. You know, I'm a New York girl and lived there for, 30 years. So this is it. I'm really excited about it.
Catherine, you're one of the sort of most iconic and pivotal runners in running history, really, especially when you're talking about gender equity. 1974 was a very different time for running. And when you won the New York City Marathon, what was that like, and how has that changed in the last 40-something years?
Great question, Michael. It's changed entirely. In the late 60s and the early 70s, we women runners really had to run first on behalf of the whole female sex. In other words, you finished the race, you ran hard, you ran the best you could to prove that women could do it, deserved to be there, and to really, you know, to carry the flag for all the females. I have to say, all the men in running have been wonderful to us. And so in New York, we found especially sympathetic audiences. A lot of the confrontations came in Boston, but they were from officials, not from the runners themselves. Mm-hmm. But in New York, it was even the officials were throwing themselves out there and saying, come on, we should let these women run, et cetera. Fred Lebo, in particular, the founder of the New York City Marathon, and in a way the creator of the Big City Marathon globally, was a real champion of women. Not because he wasn't himself a bit of a male chauvinist pig, I have to say that, but okay. because he knew that women were getting great publicity. But he also believed in women's equality. You know, he was a guy who was a religious persecutee. You know, he hid from the Nazis in the war as a Jew, and so you know the fact of freedom and equality rang very, very strongly with Fred, and he saw that with women's suppression, and he wanted to give women the freedom to run. He believed in people being the hero in their own lives, and they could feel that through running. So that was very, very important. But the era of women in 74, yeah, we really were very competitive, first of all, with ourselves. It was interesting. When I won the New York City Marathon in 74, believe it or not, I was very, very disappointed. Not with winning, of course. A win is a win. But I had hoped desperately to break 3 hours in that race. Which is mighty, four times over those hills in Central Park. Mm-hmm. But the day dawned very, very hot. It was almost 100 degrees Fahrenheit and very, very humid. And, you know, you don't have too many opportunities to run. Everybody has to run under the same conditions. That's the day of the race, and that's when the starting gun goes off. So off I went in a feeble attempt to try to break 3 hours. And then a thunderstorm broke 10Ks from the finish. That electrified the whole city. I mean, it was crashing thunder and lightning and pouring rain, and we finished in ankle-deep water, flooding of the park. I still ran a 3:07, and I think probably that was my hardest ever marathon, and probably, in a way, well, the time didn't reflect it, one of my best performances, because 6 months later, I ran a 2:51 at Boston. So I knew I had it in the bank, but I often wonder if the conditions had been really great that day. I was so ready to run a very, very fast race, what I could have done. But I won the New York City Marathon, and ironically, here's another funny story. It has all these years later now, it is the biggest margin of victory in the history of the New York City Marathon.
Really?
It's 27 minutes.
Wow.
Now,
that's never going to happen again.
Yeah.
It's never going to happen again. But see, that's just testimony to how few women there were.
Right.
You know, that could never happen today in a million years.
Oh, of course not.
But it was an amazing experience. And you know, all of these races counted so much, Michael, for getting women advanced and getting us, you know, further and further into the realm of equality. And each race gave me many ideas for organization, which, of course, then I went into myself.
A lot has changed since 1967, since you first ran the Boston Marathon in the last 50 years, of course. But where are some areas where women's running and maybe women in sport still needs improvement from your perspective?
Yeah, that's great. I was just on a panel yesterday with Carly Lloyd, the great soccer star, you know, World Cup champion, mm-hmm. 2 gold medals. And we're still talking about, you know, where women's sports is going. Very interestingly, I think running has led a huge charge for women in sports everywhere, as has Title IX and a lot of legislation, of course, to help us with our equality. But there are more women runners now in the United States, 58%, and I think Canada is even higher. I think it's like 64%. I'm not sure the data is out there.
I think it's
and there are more
like
women runners. Sorry?
It's something like that for sure, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's astronomical. And it's also, amazingly enough, the same in Japan. Hmm. And the reason is because it's, you know, the women are feeling the sense of equality. But the point is, and of course, running is easy, accessible, can be done alone with a group, et cetera. You don't have to join a team. You don't have to be an Olympic athlete, blah, blah, blah. But by being out there in our, not thousands, but now our millions, we are paving the way for other women to have breakthroughs in sports and realize they too can be athletes at any age and with any ability. So it's been phenomenal, the social change. In fact, it seems to me that women's running is nothing less than a social revolution, mm-hmm. because it's changed women's lives in so many ways. It transforms them, empowers them, and lets them know that they can do things in the rest of their lives that they didn't believe they could do.
Mm-hmm. And so kind of on that note then, why don't you talk to us about the 10 women who will be running with you as well. Tell us a little bit about your work with 261 Fearless and how that has made a pretty big impact in your life recently.
Yeah, and actually, Sinead, we call it 261, not 261.
Right.
Because we're a global charity, and 261, the individual numbers, articulating them like that translate better than the 61. Because, mm-hmm. you know, different languages have ways of mm-hmm. doing, you know, the double-digit numbers.
Yeah, that makes
so
sense.
So we make it. Yeah, it does. Anyway, 261 was my bid number in the Boston Marathon that the official mm-hmm. tried to rip off of me when he tried to throw me out of the race.
Right.
And that organically, that number has come to mean fearless in the face of adversity. And we harnessed this number, created the charity, a nonprofit called 261 Fearless, to do exactly what Michael was asking, which is what is lying ahead. You know, we may have 58% of the runners in the United States and in Canada being women, but there are parts of the world where women have no opportunities whatsoever, even mm-hmm. to put one foot in front of the other. 261 Fearless aims to reach those women with our fearlessness and those fearful women and make them fearless through running. I know it sounds almost Pollyanna-ish, but really putting one foot in front of the other empowers women. And that, as I said before, translates into all areas of their lives. So we need now to direct touch them and communicate with them. Communication, we have established a terrific website, www.261fearless.org, and there's a lot of information there. We encourage everybody to go there and communicate with each other, join us. But more importantly, maybe, is actually the direct touch part, where we're starting clubs all over the world. Mm-hmm. We're training women to be leaders of starting a club, of how to create a non-judgmental, non-competitive environment where women run safely together and share the secrets of their soul and really gain empowerment from each other. So doing that in different cultures and different societies is not the easiest thing, but what we do is we give the leader, the trainer, the ability to go in and through our course train the trainer and take that course and start a club in her own community and help those women. So that is, in a nutshell, you know, what it's all about. It's not like, hey, let's just show up and run and have coffee. That's easy. That's easy. We want women to form this community and even form their own nonprofit, which they can have as a small club, or they can turn it into a nonprofit business, which I think is important, because then women also learn to have a business model at the same time of empowering other women.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the more interesting things that has sort of transpired in the last maybe 20 or 30 years, obviously with the dominance of East African runners in distance running, also what has happened is that that's empowered a lot of women in these countries, which are countries that often are, you know, sort of unfortunately male-dominated societies. You know, Catherine, you've covered the sport as a journalist for a long time, as well as an elite runner. What's your perspective on that?
I'll tell you, nothing, Michael, would have prepared me for actually going to Kenya and actually mm-hmm. seeing how these people live. And I would say that Kenya is probably one of the most advanced countries in Africa. Mm-hmm, so yes. So when I saw women who were, I wouldn't even say second-class citizens, I would say third-class citizens, and their children, you know, struggling and working all day just to carry water back and forth, to have clean water to live, was shocking to me. And what I also saw, which was so fabulous, was the women who could run began running, getting out of Kenya, earning prize money and taking the money back and sanitizing water and building wells and building schools and inoculating kids and changing the fabric of their societies. And so no longer were they third-class citizens, but they became very revered members of the community. It's a male-dominated society, but the women who succeed like that are dominant. And what I think what's going to be very, very cool is when these women get into politics, it's going to change the landscape.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it's amazing what running can do. And to see that is just phenomenal. And to see the incredible amount of talent that exists. And it's not just because they live in the Rift Valley and they're at altitude. Of course, that's an advantage to have thousands of years of more red blood corpuscles in order to carry the oxygen in your system. But, you know, talent is everywhere in the world. It's everywhere. It only needs this an opportunity. And again, you know, I'm very, very excited about the prospect of 261 Fearless going into Africa. That's down the road a ways for us, but we'll be there, and we're going to be there in the Mideast, and we're going to start making those changes. By the way, did you see the news yesterday? Saudi Arabia has allowed women now to drive.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, when you said that you were going to make headway into the Middle East, that was actually the first thing that came to my mind.
You know, I mean, there goes that from my speech, but I can, because I'm saying, you know, countries that don't even let their women drive. But as my husband dryly, everybody knows Roger Robinson, you know, he's a wonderful writer and raconteur. He said, oh, wonderful, Saudi Arabia is moving women into the 19th century.
Yes, right, exactly, exactly.
But again, it's in a way, you know, that's a big door. That is open now, a crack, and you keep pushing it, it's going to open further and further.
Oh, totally.
You know, one of my greatest thrilling moments was seeing, her name slips my mind, but on the track in 2012 at the London Olympics, when running for Saudi, running the 800 meters, and Sarah Attar.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Oh, my God. It was, to me, I burst into tears seeing it. And when she ran, she got the standing ovation all the way around the track. It was superb. And I'm saying, hey, you know, did Saudi go into that kicking and screaming? Of course they did. Mm-hmm. But they had to do it if they were going to get a team there. And she, no matter what the situation was, she was on the track alone and she ran. And I thought that's phenomenal.
So I guess 261 Fearless is the idea behind it then is to sort of create a little bit of movement and energy in that direction after these sorts of big situations happen, where you want to try to connect with people on the ground. You want to try to start forming organizations locally in these countries and start getting women to connect with each other and to build their own sort of sub organizations, I guess, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Precisely. It's got to grow from the grassroots up. And, you know, we toyed with the idea of doing big events, 261 events, and having women there. Events are very appealing and they're goal oriented. And yet, you know, if a woman is timid about even going outside and putting on a pair of sneakers and just walking or jogging down her own street, she's not going to show up for a race.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we need to get her out of the house and on her own feet. And we need to give her the courage to be able to do that, because, you know, it's not easy. I mean, we talk about these women, let's say, like they're all in the Mideast or North Africa, but I mean, she could be the woman living next door to you.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Actually, that segues really nicely into the next thing that I wanted to ask you, which is just, you know, speaking to, you know, an average Canadian runner who's listening right now, who's maybe just gotten into running recently, who's a little bit shy or nervous about the sport, like, what do you want these typical average Canadians to know before they're lacing up and before they're getting out for their runs?
Well, what we want them to know is that they can do it, and that they're always welcome, and that they're not alone out there. Mm-hmm. And what 26 is interesting about Canada, because right now we're really making a major push into Canada to try to create awareness for 261 Fearless. We're staging a virtual run. I believe it is on October the 14th. Might be the 15th. I'm sorry. Go to the website and check. I should know that off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. But a virtual run for Canadian women. We're going to be doing some partnering with as a Fearless Partner event at the Niagara Falls Women's Half Marathon and at the Toronto Marathon, where we will encourage women to come and hear about 261, take part in a 5K or the half marathon or the marathon, whatever they want to do, meet me, meet the other 261ers, and get the background on starting a club in their own areas. I would really love us to get clubs up into northern reaches, remoter areas of Canada where women have so few opportunities. What great friendships they could have in those towns when there's not a lot else. and empowering each other. I mean, I could see fantastic things even in Inuit communities. I would really love, really, really love to help empower those women. And I think we can do that.
Nice. Catherine, it's been a really big year for you, and we're talking about all this important stuff in this conversation. You ran Boston in April, New York's now around the corner. I just kind of wanted to ask you to reflect on the past year. I mean, I know I was speaking to you last October, so almost a year ago now, where you're just kind of coming into your Boston training. Why don't you just kind of reflect on the past year and some of the big moments that have happened for you? What has it been like?
You know, I want to tell you, crossing the finish line in the Boston Marathon was one of the happiest days of my life. Mm-hmm. And it was happy for me because, well, first of all, the race was wonderful and the crowds were wonderful. And I did it. and the pressure was off. You know, we had 117 women and 8 intrepid guys running for 261 Fearless, and they're raising close to $1 million. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on my back.
Yes, of course.
To tell you, my legs were like cooked spaghetti. So to come across the finish line and fall into the arms of my wonderful husband and give a very embarrassing, lingering kiss was, you know, it was the stuff of fairy tales. But what it was, the most gratifying part, was that this was a race of celebration and passing the torch, of looking back at how much we had done in 50 years, of going from this girl being thrown out of the Boston Marathon to 50-50 in the Boston Marathon, and to more women runners than men in the U.S., and then a look to the future. What was gratifying was that the media, and that was a bank of media, there was huge media there, really understood that. It was no longer the Catherine Switzer story, a man attacking her in the race, and an old history story. It was about the look to the future, about what are the next 50 years going to look like. And it's going to be very exciting, and it's going to be your generation that's going to be making that change. I said, you know, I would love to be there in 50 years, guys, but I'm not going to be there. So you're going to have to do it. And we've got great momentum now. We've got wonderful momentum, and we have incredible communication. So this last year has been very, very powerful. I've been asked to do a lot of speaking, and that's a great privilege because you get in front of big audiences and you tell them this story, and I hope that it leaves them inspired to go out and start carrying that torch forward, not just with running, but with everything. But, you know, women now in the political environment, not just globally, but boy, in the United States, you know, we've got to keep our rights and fight for everything we have earned and push it forward. And as I said in my speech yesterday, the price, you know, it's not my line, it's a beautiful line, but the price of freedom is constant vigilance, and we need to be out there and be on our mark all the time. Fortunately, running really preps you for that. It's great. So that's what this year has been like. I'm a little anxious now, of course, about New York. The training is not as good as I would hope it would be because I've been all over the map, but I'm excited about it. I'm excited about it, and I'm looking forward to the streets of New York. Fortunately, you know, I don't have to worry about how fast I run anymore, which is a real blessing.
That's true. Well, we're excited for you as well, Catherine. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Great. And with all my 261 team who's getting ready for New York, I'm wishing them all the luck, and I'm giving them all my thanks in the world, you know, for everything they do, and you too.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Catherine. And now it's time for our weekly recommendations. Sinead, what do you have for us this week?
Well, I'm going to recommend a pair of shorts. The Arc'teryx Lycra Short W is what they're called. I kind of struggled to find the right pair of shorts, as I know you know, because I talk about it all the time.
Yes.
So I actually ran a half marathon over the weekend wearing these shorts. They just work really well for me. They're a little bit longer than some of the other shorts that I have in my wardrobe. So it's just kind of, it gives me a little bit of that extra coverage. And of course, they're really lightweight and everything that you need for running.
Are they like a split short or a half tight?
They're like onto a split short, but a little bit longer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Arc'teryx makes... They make good stuff.
They do make good stuff. I find that they work really well for just my body shape. And so that's you know that you like a piece of gear when you're willing to pick it out and wear it for a race. So mm-hmm. that's what I wore over the weekend.
You know you trust it when you pick it for a race.
Yes.
Excellent.
Exactly.
My recommendation this week is somewhat broad. We chatted with Catherine Switzer earlier, obviously, mm-hmm. and her husband is notable runner. He held the Masters, the 40 plus world record in the marathon mm-hmm. for quite a while. And of course, also probably our greatest running historian.
Yes, definitely.
And he's written for us mm-hmm. for Canadian Running on several occasions. And
he has.
Roger and I have actually kind of joked, I'm not sure if it was actually a joke, gone back and forth about, you know, how he's written so many historical pieces on great Canadian runners that he should put together like a history book.
Oh, he should.
Yeah.
He would be the one to write it.
He would be. I mean, he's already kind of written it by, you know, he just sew together 9 or 10 of the features that he's mm-hmm. written for us over the years. And I recommend anything that Roger Robinson has ever written because I find his writing is really enjoyable. He knows obviously so much about the sport, about the history of the sport, about all the little details, and he's able to paint a really clear picture. He's really good at telling that of putting you sort of in the moment and creating a scene mm-hmm. from something that happened maybe like 100 years ago or 50 years ago. And I love reading his historical stuff on running. And we have quite a few of his stories up online. Those that are not online, we'll make a concerted effort to get them online. Sorry, Sinead, I just gave you more work there.
That's okay. I already know of a few that are online and we can link to them in the show notes as well.
Absolutely. And I, in particular, quite enjoyed the piece that he wrote about Tom Longboat, which I found really interesting and sort of just dove a little bit deeper into who Tom Longboat was mm-hmm. and why he's such an important and pivotal character in mm-hmm. Or person in Canadian running history. Mm-hmm. And as well, Gerard Côté, multiple Boston Marathon champion. He wrote a really great piece about Côté as well. Mm-hmm. So we'll make sure that we have a links to some of those stories yes. on our show notes.
For sure.
All right. Thanks very much, Sinead.
Thanks.
Make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes and Apple Podcast, and we're also now available on Stitcher and Google Play. Make sure to follow our Facebook page at facebook.com/theshakeoutpodcast and on Twitter at @shakeoutpodcast and Instagram @shakeoutpodcast.